Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Bhutang dhammang sangkhang namassami. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, a blessed one, the Buddha, was living at Sarvati in Jetus Grove, and out of Pindaka's park. There he addressed amongst us, Bhikkhus. Venerable sir, they replied, and a venerable one said this. Monks, on one occasion I was living at Ukata in the Subhaga Grove at the root of the royal sal tree. On that occasion, a pernicious, is the fancy word meaning for a wrong view, had arisen in Bhaka the Brahma thus. This is permanent. This is everlasting. This is eternal. This is total. This is not subject to pass away. For this neither is born nor ages, nor dies, nor passes away, nor reappears. And beyond this there is no escape. So it's Bhaka the Brahmin, the story of, in Buddhist cosmology, of a Brahma, said when this one particular eon of existence evolves, because in Buddhism we believe in many universes, cyclical, one after another. This is basic Buddhism. And when a universe evolves, but once it gets to a certain level of evolution, a being appears in this universe descending from some of the jhana realms. And they're descending into this human realm as a Brahma, thinking it's the first person to come here, gets the view that they are the firstborn, eternal, everlasting, because they don't know, they can't remember what went before. So this is an interesting take on the concept of God, where the Buddha said, yeah, there are beings, you know, very high beings in the sense of very refined, but they are not the creator of the universe. The universe came first, and then the being was, as it were, born into this universe from the realms of the mind. And the firstborn has the delusion that they're the boss, they're the chief, they're sort of like the idea of a creator, all-powerful God. And he's thinking that this is eternal. He cannot see that even his own existence is changing, that he was born into this realm and will actually leave this realm. Is that clear? Sort of. Anyway, it may become clear as we go along. And the Buddha was saying, I knew with my mind the thought in the mind of Bhaka the God. So just as quickly as a strong man might extend his flexed arm or flex his extended arm, this is the classic way of a monk describing psychic powers. So you don't actually struggle, just as if stretching your arm, if you want to sort of do these things, you just do them. I vanished from the root of the royal sala tree in the Subhaga Grove at Ukata and appeared in the Brahma world. So Bhaka the God saw me coming in the distance and said, come, good sir, welcome, good sir. It is long, good sir, since you found an opportunity to come here. So God is very actually welcoming at first. It is long, good sir, since you found an opportunity to come here. Now, good sir, this is permanent, this is everlasting, this is eternal, this is total. This is not subject to pass away, for this neither is born nor ages nor dies nor passes away nor reappears, and beyond this there is no escape, and like an ultimate truth. When this was said, I told Bhaka the God, the worthy Bhaka the God has lapsed into ignorance. He has lapsed into ignorance in that he says of the impermanent, the anicca, that it is permanent, in that he says of what is transient, that it is everlasting, of the non-eternal, that it is eternal, of the incomplete, or incomplete, that it is total, of what is subject to pass away, that it is not subject to pass away, of what is born, ages, dies, passes away, and reappears, that it neither is born, nor ages, nor dies, nor passes away, nor reappears. And when there is an escape beyond this state, he says there is no escape. So the Buddha is actually arguing with Brahma, who thinks this is everlasting. Him, his state, is permanent, total, the summit, and there's nothing beyond that. Nothing beyond God. Before we go further, any comment? Okay, let's keep going then. Then Mara. And Mara lives just below the realm of God. And Mara lives in the realm, and this is interesting, the realm of those who exert power over other people's creations, especially their thoughts. He's like a deceiver. And so Mara, very powerful god in the Buddhist hierarchy, but he's into the power trip, the control freak. And so he took possession of one of the members of Brahma's assembly and told me, monk, do not disbelieve, well actually, do not insult God. Do not disbelieve him, for this God is the great God, the overlord, the untranscended, of infallible vision, wielder of mastery, Lord, maker and creator, most high providence, master and father of those that are and ever can be. Before your time, monk, there were recluses and Brahmins in this world who condemned earth through disgust with earth, who condemned water through disgust with water, condemned fire through disgust with fire, condemned air through disgust with air. In other words, they had nothing to do with like material things. In other words, they renounced material things. Who condemned beings through disgust with beings, who condemned gods through disgust with gods, who condemned Prajapati, Brahma through disgust with Brahma. In other words, they didn't even have anything to do with gods of any sort. And on the dissolution of their body, when their life was cut off, they became established in an inferior body. In other words, they got a very bad rebirth because they completely rejected material things and life and gods and all that stuff. And before your time, monk, there were also requisites and Brahmins in the world who praised earth and delighted in earth, who lorded water through delight in water, lorded fire through delight in fire, lorded air through delight in air. That's the four elements, earth, air, fire and water, signifying material things. In other words, they delighted in material things and praised it. Who delighted in gods and praised gods, Prajapati, Brahma, and they praised these things and delighted in these things. And on the dissolution of their body, when their life was cut off, they became established in a superior body. They got a good rebirth. So, monk, I tell you this. Be sure, good sir. Do only as God says. Never overstep the word of God. If you overstep the word of God, monk, then like a man trying to deflect an approaching beam of light with a stick, or like a man losing his hold on earth with his hands and feet as he slips into a deep chasm, so it will befall you, monk. Be sure, good sir, do only as the God says. Never overstep the word of God. Do you not see God's assembly seated here, monk? Amara, the evil one, thus called to witness the assembly of God. Now, does that, those of you who had a Christian education, does that rhyme with some of the things you've been taught? And I've just used the word God instead of Brahma, which is a fair sort of translation there. So what happens next in this confrontation between God and the Buddha? And you can see some of the things which they say here. The great Brahma, the great God, the overlord, the untranscended, the of infallible vision, wielder of mastery, Lord, maker and creator, most high providence, master, father. Some of the same words that are used in Christianity, Islam, Judaism, in most of those Abrahamic religions. Very similar there. So you can see that what we're talking about here is very much that same concept of God. And the Buddha is saying, you're not permanent, mate. And this is what happens next. When this was said, this is the Buddha replying, I told Mara the evil one, I know you, Mara. Do not think he does not know me. You are Mara, evil one, and the Brahma and the Brahma's assembly and the members of the Brahma assembly have all fallen into your hands. They have fallen into your power. You, evil one, think, this one, in other words, the Buddha, too has fallen into my hands. He too has fallen into my power. I have not fallen into your power or your hands, evil one. I have not fallen into your power. When this was said, Bhaka the Brahma, or Bhaka the God, told me, good sir, I say of the permanent, it is permanent. Of the everlasting, it's everlasting. Of the eternal, it's eternal. Of the total, it's total. Of what is not subject to pass away, that it is not subject to pass away. of what is neither born nor ages nor passes away nor reappears, that it does not, that neither is born nor dies nor passes away nor reappears. And when there is no escape beyond this, I say there is no escape beyond this. Now, you can see here he's talking about infinite truth or ultimate reality, the total, the eternal, what neither gets born nor passes away. And he said, I know what I'm talking about, says God. And he says, before your time, monk, there were recluses and Brahmins in the world whose asceticism, their practice, lasted as long as your whole life. Now remember, the Buddha's quite young at this time. They knew when there is an escape beyond, that there is an escape beyond. And when there's no escape beyond, that there is no escape beyond. In other words, they knew more than you. So, monk, I tell you this. You will find no escape beyond. And eventually, talking to the Buddha, you will reap only weariness and disappointment. However, monk, if you will hold to earth, you'll be close to me, within my domain, for me to work my will upon you and punish you. If you hold, in other words, attach to water, to fire, to air, in other words, you attach to material things, you attach to beings, to gods, to Prajapati, is supposed to be a god lesson, the big god, Brahma, you'll be close to me, within my domain, for me to work my will on and punish. I know that too, Brahma. I know, this is Buddha replying, if I do attach to earth, I shall be close to you, within your domain, for you to work your will upon me and punish me. If I were attached to water, to fire, to air, to beings, to gods, little gods, to medium gods, Prajapati, to big gods like you, I shall be close to you, within your domain, for you to work your will upon and punish me. Further, I understand your reach and your sway to extend thus far. Bhaka, the god, has this much power, this much might, this much influence. In other words, he's saying, you've only got so much power and reach, Brahma. And that really upset God. Now, good sir, how far do you understand my reach and my sway to extend? And the Buddha replies in verse, as far as moon and sun revolve, shining and lighting up the quarters, over a thousandfold such world does your sovereignty extend. And there you know the high and low, and those with lust and free from lust, the state that is thus and otherwise, the coming and going of beings. Brahma, I understand your reach and your sway to extend thus far. Back of the Brahma has this much power, this much might, and this much influence. First of all, as when I first read this, as a scientist, you see, as far as the moon and sun revolve, you can see that's our solar system. Shining and lighting up the quarters, over a thousandfold such world, over a thousand solar systems. And that's actually similar, that each sort of thousandfold world systems, you have like one big god. But the Buddha's actually saying that on other solar systems there are more such gods. And that's actually in a little sutra in the Anguttara Nikaya. So there's billions, untold numbers of these thousandfold solar systems. Not just one, but a thousand solar systems. And many of those. And each one of a thousand such solar systems, you have one big god. So he said, you know, just one of many. And that's what he said. And in that area, you know all these beings. But, Brahma, there are three other bodies or realms which you neither know nor see, but which I know and see, said a body. There is the bodies or the realm called the gods of streaming radiance, from which you passed away and reappeared here. The gods of streaming radiance, that is the realm, the mind realm, which is basically second jhana realm. If you have experience of second jhana, that very still mind state, a pure mind, nothing to do with the body, that's the place where that Brahma had been in, really, really still, and came back and was the firstborn into this world. It's a jhana realm. Now, what the Bhaka knew, first jhana realm and this other realms, but didn't know anything beyond that first jhana realm. And the Buddha said, there's other realms which you don't know of. He said, and that's where you came from. You weren't just God forever. You had a previous life, a previous existence. in this jhana realm existence. I know that you don't. There is a body called the gods of streaming radiance, Abhasara Deva, from which you passed away and reappeared here. Because you have dwelt here long, your memory of that has lapsed, and hence you do not know or see it, but I know and see it. Thus, Brahma, in regard to direct knowledge, I do not stand merely as the same level of you. How then could I know less? Rather, God, I know more than you. That's really upsetting, God. There is a body called the gods of refulgent glory, the Supakina. There is a body called the gods of the great fruit, the Wehapala. Refulgent glory, that's based on the third jhana. Now these jhana realms are accessible to human beings. This is what you get when you get really still. Very peaceful, when the mind almost stops. You get incredibly refined states of mind, completely independent of the body and of the material world. If you get some understanding of those jhanas, you understand what the Buddha is talking about here. These are realms which are so still, they last for hundreds of thousands of years if you die and go and get take a rebirth in that realm. You're incredibly still. And when that sort of state breaks away, it's impermanent like all other these states, then if you pass away at the right time, you get reborn into maybe the first being, and then you become God. If you're deluded and think you are God, the firstborn, if your memory's not so good. So, that's the refulgent glory, Supakina, that's the third jhana. Wehapala is the fourth jhana. You do not know or see that, but I know and see that. That's Brahma. In regard to direct knowledge, I do not stand merely at the same level as you. How then could I know less? Rather, I know more than you. Brahma, or God, having directly known earth, what earth is, sometimes in Pali, and this is for those of you who are getting deep into this sutta, directly known earth as earth. Does that ring a bell for you, for those of you who have first studied the Satipatthana Sutta? Remember to... It's an idiom, yes, I kept on saying. This is another example of that idiom, where you are mindful of the body in the body, feelings in feelings, mind in mind, mind objects in mind objects. You know that sort of mistranslation? It's like directly know earth as earth is the same. It means you just know earth. You know, you understand what this material thing called earth truly is. So this is another example of that idiom in Pali. And I just pointed it out because sometimes that confuses people who study Satipatthana Sutta. I think something, you know, to know the body in the body, that's something which is mysterious. It just means you're just mindful of the body, that's all. And here it just means you know what earth is. Like solid things. I did not conversion with the earth. So, Brahma, having directly known what earth is, and having directly known that which is commensurate or equal with earth, the earthiness of earth, in other words, what it's all about, I did not claim to be like solid, I did not claim to be in earth, do not claim to be apart from it, do not claim earth to be mine, I did not affirm earth. It is that it has nothing to do with me. Thus, Brahma, in regard to direct knowledge, I do not stand merely as the same level as you. How could then I know less, rather know more than you? Having directly known water, the fluid part of the world, fire, air, those four elements, having directly understood what these four elements are, what material things are made of, I did not sort of claim the me, that I am my body, to be something apart from my body, to be contained in a body, and I did not affirm body is really important, or beings, these are Buddhas, a type of being, gods, Prajapati, Brahma, even the gods of streaming ravens, the gods of refulgent glory, the gods of grapefruit, even overlords, all as all, having directly known all of these things, and what's equal to those things, I did not claim to be any of these things. I did not claim to be my essence, my soul, to be contained in any of things. I did not think that a self was apart from these things. I did not claim that all of these things to belong to me. I did not affirm anything. I did not affirm the all. Thus, Brahma, in regard to direct knowledge, I do not stand merely at the same level as you. How then could I know less? Rather, I know more than you.
Now, it might be a difficult passage, but you can get the idea of what the Buddha's saying. He's saying, having understood all of these things, material things, all these different levels of beings, you know, even higher than the Brahma could remember, into these jhana realms, having directly known these things, he never thought that these things were his essential self, what he was made of, his soul, or his soul was contained in these things, or his soul was apart from these things. He understood much deeper than that. He said, that's why I know more than you. And Brahma said, he didn't believe what the Buddha said. Good sir, if you claim to directly know that which is not commensurate with the allness of all, the totality of totality, may your claim not turn out to be vain and empty. In other words, God was saying, oh, you're an idiot, you don't know what you're talking about. And now we come to a statement which so many monks start to comment and question. The consciousness that makes no showing, nor has to do with finiteness, nor claiming being with respect to all. This is the vijnana anidasana. Sometimes it's called the non-manifest consciousness. Anantang means with no boundary. So bodhabhavang, this is not claiming being with respect to all. That was, every monk has their best translation there. And they have other translations of that term. If I can just find it, I'll just pause for a minute while I get the quote from the Diga. I was rushed before I came in here, didn't get it. But it's also repeated in more fullness in another sutta, the same verse. And I'm just going to get that translation for you as well, so you get some bigger idea of what it is. Digha 1185. Again, this is also part of a Kaivada Sutta. And here they have, where consciousness is signless, boundless, or luminous. The consciousness that makes no showing, they call it here the consciousness that is signless. Nor has to do with finiteness, they say boundless. Instead of not claiming being with respect to all, they have luminous, all luminous. Because it's a very difficult translation, this verse. I will come back to this afterwards with my answer to what this verse really means. So the consciousness which is like not showing, nor has to do with finite, boundless, nor claiming being or fully luminous. He said, this is not commensurate with earth, with water, with air, with fire, with any of these gods, with any of these beings. It's something completely different from these things. So this is like almost like an ultimate reality which the Buddha is pointing to, which God has no idea of what he's talking about. And so, obviously, the Buddha is trying to sort of astound God, and God is not really impressed. So God said, good sir, I shall vanish from you. So now, instead of having an intellectual battle, we start the psychic battle between God and the Buddha. Good sir, I shall vanish from you. Vanish from me if you can, God. Then back of the God saying, I shall vanish from the reckless Gotama. I shall vanish from the reckless Gotama. That's Buddha. Was unable to vanish. Thereupon I said, Brahma, I shall vanish from you. Vanish from me if you can, good sir. Then I performed such a feat of supernormal power that the Brahma and the Brahma's assembly and the members of the Brahma's assembly could hear my voice but could not see me. And after I had vanished, I uttered a stanza. Having seen fear in every mode of being, and in beings seeking for non-being, I did not form any mode of being, nor did I cling to any delight in being. That's a really good translation. So there, the Buddha went beyond the sight of Brahma, and Brahma got quite confused, because he could hear the voice, and you see this is what the Buddha actually said, having seen fear in every type of being, even being a god. is subject to suffering when you pass away. And even seeing fear in a being seeking for annihilation, seeing not to become, not to be, which is a very, very profound form of craving. It's called the craving to annihilate, to extinguish, to stop. If you try to stop something, it's you controlling things again. So I did not affirm any mode of being. I didn't sort of delight in anything. Nor did I cling to any such delight in being. And that's actually the description of the path to being fully enlightened. To seeing fear, seeing the danger in just being, any type of being, even a god. So not affirming it, not delighting in it, then the cause for renewal of being is stopped. At that, the god and the god's assembly, and the members of the god's assembly, were struck with wonder and amazement, saying, "It is wonderful, sirs, it is marvellous, the great power and the great might of the Buddha. We have never before seen or heard of any other recluse or Brahmin who had such great power and such great might as has this recluse Gotama who went forth in the Sakyan clan. Sirs are living in a generation that delights in being, that takes delight in being, that rejoices in being. He's extirpated, extinguished being together with its root." So he's finally convinced Brahma that the Buddha's knowledge is superior than God. And not doing it just for, psychic power gave God the evidence that this Buddha was up to something, but it was the words which are the most important. The Buddha was talking about something, obviously Brahma was conscious, but something which was far beyond what the God could understand. This consciousness that has no showing, nor claim, has to do with finiteness, nor claiming being with respect to all. And in verse 27, how he actually got to that place, by seeing fear in every type of being, every type of conscious being, and even trying to annihilate that being, not affirming being, and not delighting in being. Now before we go on to the next part about Mara asking the Buddha, "Great, okay, you're enlightened, we understand that, greater than God. Now shut up and enjoy yourself, but please don't share this knowledge with anybody else." But before we go on to that, I was going to say that we have the full poem here, the Consciousness That Makes No Showing poem. And this was where the question was, "Where do earth, water, fire and air no footing find? Where are long and short, small and great, fair and foul? Where is Nama Rupa, name and form, wholly destroyed?" And the answer is, where consciousness makes no showing, nor has to do with finiteness, which is luminous, the same poem here. That is where earth, water, fire and air find no footing. They are both long and short, small and great, fair and foul, disappear. Their name and form are wholly destroyed. With the cessation of consciousness, this is all destroyed. So that this little poem here, which is only in brief in the Brahmanimantanika Sutta, is in full in the Kaivada Sutta. And for those of you who are sharp and know your Buddhism, you can see it's where Nama Rupa is destroyed, name and form, where it's cessation of consciousness, where it stops. So here is a consciousness that makes no showing. It's not something really hard to understand. It's a consciousness which has ended, which is finished. The end of consciousness, all consciousness, the stopping of things. Where name and form, the Nama Rupa, which are the objects of consciousness, where that all stops, wholly destroyed. Remember that consciousness has to have an object of consciousness. The Buddha called it like two sheaves of reeds resting on each other. If one of those sheaves of reeds is taken away, the other one falls down. Consciousness and its objects. Objects and consciousness are those two reeds. So if you take away the objects of conscious experience, then consciousness vanishes. So here, when the objects of consciousness, Nama Rupa, disappears, then consciousness finishes. When consciousness finishes, the objects finish. That's the consciousness that makes no showing, which is Anantang, not any boundaries anymore. And where it says Sabbato Pabang, here it says in this sutta Sabbato Pahang. And the word Pahang is also a contraction in my insights of abandoned, from Pahatabang or Pahinati, completely destroyed, abandoned, finished. So if I was translating this, I'd say the consciousness that no longer appears, that no longer bound, completely finished. That is where name and earth, water, fire and air don't find any footing, when there's no consciousness to give it footing. Where long, short, small, great, fair and foul, there's no consciousness makes those distinctions. But the objects of consciousness are wholly destroyed. Parinibbana, the cessation of consciousness. He said that's something which Brahma just cannot know. Still stuck to this consciousness is everything, the consciousness of a God, the cosmic God consciousness. This is eternal, this is the great, from this there is no escape. That's what God was talking about. And the Buddha knows. Not just the consciousness, the highest consciousness of God. Actually, it wasn't the highest consciousness. The consciousness of God consciousness, there's these other jhana realms, second, third, fourth jhana realms, which are the more superior consciousness than that of God. The God hangs around between the first jhana and coming out of the first jhana. For those of you who know your meditation, upachara and jhana, between those two states, that's where God oscillates. Have I confused you all? Some of you, yeah. Do you want to ask any questions on this? Yeah, come on. Correct. Yes, because you can't speak anywhere else. This is happening in the Upachara realms. There was this Kaivada Sutta. This is Sutta number 11 in the Digha Nikaya. This is what Brahma didn't know. Kaivada was a very powerful monk, and he wanted to find the answer. Where do earth, water, fire, and air find no footing? And he managed to develop a deep meditation. He went to find these lower gods and say, where do water, earth, fire and air find no footing? And the lower gods said, we don't know. Go and ask the next level of gods. And the next level of gods, look, we don't know. Ask those ones above us. And he got sent all the way up to Brahma. And when he got to Brahma, when he went up to him and said, friend, where do the four great elements, earth, water, fire and air, cease without remainder? To which the great Brahma, great God, replied, monk, I am God, great Brahma, the conqueror, the unconquered, the all-seeing, all-powerful, the Lord, the maker and the creator, the ruler, appointer and orderer, father of all that have been and shall be. The second time the monk said, friend, I did not ask if you are God, great God and all that sort of stuff. I asked you where the four great elements cease without remainder. The second time God said, I am God, the great God. And the third time the monk said, friend, I did not ask you that. I ask you where the four great elements, earth, water, fire, air, cease without remainder. Then the great Brahma took that monk by the arm, led him aside and said, monk, these other gods believe there is nothing God does not see, there is nothing he does not know, there is nothing he is unaware of. That is why I did not speak in front of them. But monk, I don't know where the four great elements cease without remainder. And therefore, monk, you have acted wrongly. You have acted incorrectly by going beyond the Buddha and going in search of an answer to the question elsewhere. Now, monk, you just go to the Buddha and put this question to him, and whatever answer he gives, accept that. So this is actually obviously comes afterwards. Where do everything cease? And God doesn't know that. So he says, look, I can't say I don't know this in front of all my friends because they think I'm God. So you just go and ask the Buddha. Sorry? Yeah, sometimes we don't know. Go and ask the Pope, and the Pope, well, I don't know. But anyway, this is, so these two actually two grow together here. It's interesting. So it doesn't actually say, some of the people actually that Buddhists believe there's no God. No, there is a God, but it's not an eternal, not all-powerful, all-knowing God. Okay, let's go to the next part of the, which is, again, an interesting part, from paragraph 29. Then Ma, the evil one, took possession of a member of the Brahmins' assembly, another one, and said to me, good sir, if that is what you know, it's not affirming that this Buddha really knows what he's talking about. If that is what you have discovered, do not guide your lay disciple or those gone forth. Don't teach the Dhamma to your disciple or to those gone forth. Create no yearning in your lay disciples or in those gone forth. Because before your time, monk, there were recluses and Brahmins in the world claiming to be fully enlightened, accomplished and fully enlightened. And they guided their lay disciples. And those gone forth, they taught the Dhamma to their lay disciples and to those gone forth. They created yearning in their lay disciples and those gone forth, yearning to become enlightened. And on the dissolution of the body, when their life is cut off, they became established in an inferior body. Again, it's all fear trip. If you don't behave, you go to hell. If you behave, you go to heaven. Before your time, monk, there were also Rekhas and Brahmins in the world claiming to be fully enlightened, and they did not guide their lay disciples or those gone forth. They did not teach the Dhamma to their lay disciples or those gone forth. They created no yearning in their lay disciples or those gone forth. And on the dissolution of the body, when their life was cut off, they became established in a superior body. They went to heaven. So, monk, I tell you this. Be sure, good sir, to abide inactive, devoted to a pleasant abiding here and now. This is better left undeclared. And so, good sir, do not inform anyone else. So the Maya was admitting the Buddha was enlightened, but didn't want him to go and teach anybody. When this was said, I told Mara the evil one, I know you, evil one. Do not think he does not know me. You are Mara, the evil one. It is not out of compassion for their wealth that you speak thus. It is without compassion for their wealth that you speak thus. You think thus, evil one, those to whom the recluse Gotama teaches the Dhamma will escape from my sphere. Those recluses and Brahmins of yours, evil one, who claim to be accomplished and fully enlightened, were not accomplished and fully enlightened. But I, who claim to be accomplished and fully enlightened, am accomplished and fully enlightened. If the Tathagata, which is the way the Buddha talks about himself, teaches the Dhamma to disciples, he is such, evil one. And if the Tathagata does not teach the disciples, he is such. In other words, whether he teaches or not doesn't affect him as a Buddha. If the Tathagata guides disciples, he is such. If the Tathagata does not guide disciples, he is such. Why is that? Because the Tathagata has abandoned all the taints that defile, that being renewal of being, give trouble, ripen in suffering, and lead to future birth, aging, and death. He has cut them off at the root, made them like a palm stump, done away with them, so they are no longer subject to future arising, just as a palm tree whose crown is cut off, incapable of further growth. So too, the Buddha has abandoned the taints that defile, cut them off at the root, made them like a palm stump, done away with them so they can no longer subject to future arising. So the Buddha is saying, whether I teach or not, it's nothing to do with me. Because he's fully enlightened, all the defilements cut off, they can't arise again. Interestingly, it says here that once you're a Buddha, once you're enlightened, they always give the similar, like a palm tree whose top is cut off, it can't arise again. Once you're enlightened, always enlightened. You can't sort of revert back again. It's a one-way street with no return. But part of that, he said, Brahma was asking him again not to teach. And the reason I wanted to pause on that, because he did that before. And apparently, according to the commentaries, this was actually done on the eighth day after the Buddha's enlightenment. But it's referred to in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, again in the Digha Nikaya. This is the story of the Buddha's final passing away. And the Buddha went to the Chapala shrine. And at the Chapala shrine, he did mention to Ananda the famous story that Buddhas, you know, if they wanted to, they can live the whole extent of their lifespan, which it was always expected to be around 120 years. And he gave the hint to Ananda, well, if you really want me to, I can live another to 120, another 40 years. But Ananda never took the hint. So the Buddha at the Chapala shrine gave up his life faculty. But this is actually how the Buddha resolved that he was going to die in 3 months. Soon after Ananda had left, Mala the evil one came to the Lord, stood to one side and said, Lord, may the blessed one now attain final nirvana. May the welfarer now attain final nirvana. Now is the time for the blessed one's final nirvana. Because the blessed Lord had said this, and this is referring to the 8th day after the enlightenment, Mara, I will not take final nirvana till I have monks, bhikkhus, who are sarvakas, in other words, at least stream winners, who are accomplished, trained, skilled, learned, knowers of the Dhamma, trained in conformity with the Dhamma, correctly trained and walking in the path of the Dhamma, who will pass on what they have gained from their teacher, teach it, declare it, establish it, expound it, analyze it, make it clear, till they shall be able by means of Dhamma to refute false teachings that have arisen and teach the Dhamma of wondrous effect. And now, Mara replied, the Blessed One has such monks and disciples. May the Blessed One Lord now attain final nirvana. May the welfare attain final nirvana. And the Blessed One Lord has also said, I will not take final nirvana till I have bhikkhunis, who are at least dream winners, who are accomplished, until I have lay men followers, till I have lay women followers, the same. Until that time I will not take final nirvana. And this is actually why he said over here that Mara in the present sutta, the invitation to Brahma, he was saying, oh, come on, have a pleasant abiding, don't do anything. And the Buddha said, no, I will not do this. And here he's saying why he won't do this. He made his resolution, according to the commentary, and there's no reason to doubt that, and it's referred to here in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, he won't pass away until he has established bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, laymen and laywomen disciples. And a lot of people have been quoting this when it comes to, should we reintroduce the bhikkhuni ordination? And said, because some people say, well, you know, the Buddha was reluctant to introduce bhikkhunis when Mahapajapati, his foster mother, came out to him and asked him, you know, for ordination. The Buddha supposed to refuse 2 or 3 times. And a lot of people say, doesn't that show a bit of misogyny on the part of the Buddha, you know, having to be persuaded to ordain bhikkhunis? And many people forget to refer to the 8th day after enlightenment, where the Buddha was asked by Mara, please become enlightened, don't teach anyone. And the Buddha said, no, I will not become enlightened until I've established the bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, laymen and laywomen. It was his original plan to do this from the 8th day after his enlightenment. And that's a very interesting little argument which we're monks who know what they're talking about are spreading around. It was the Buddha's plan from the very beginning, according to these suttas, to establish bhikkhus and bhikkhunis from the 8th day after his enlightenment. So, if there was any hesitation in ordaining Mahapajapati, it would not be hesitating in ordination, maybe thinking the time's not right, the place is not right, but certainly it was his intention from the very beginning to have nuns and monks, laymen, laywomen, disciples. And he wouldn't leave the world and enter Parinibbana until that was fulfilled. And at this Chapala shrine, Mara was saying, I remember that statement, now you've got that, you've got lots of bhikkhus, lots of bhikkhunis, now you can take your Parinibbana and leave. And the Buddha then says, okay, in 3 months I will pass away. Main point, it was the Buddha's intention from the very beginning, or almost the beginning, 8 days after his enlightenment, to have a bhikkhuni sangha. He wasn't persuaded or cajoled. It was his own idea. And going back to this sutta, because the Buddha says, I'm enlightened, basically, it doesn't really matter whether I teach or I don't teach. And that's because Mara was unable to reply, and because it began with the Brahma's invitation, the discourse is called on the invitation of a Brahma, or the invitation of a god. So that's a little sutta, a teaching about the Buddha's relationship to what we call a god. and the synopsis of it, there, God thinking, that stuff of God consciousness is permanent, eternal, nothing beyond that. The Buddha goes up to him out of compassion and teaches him something beyond that, saying that you've come down from another realm, these jhana realm, second jhana realm, to this universe, firstborn. You can understand why you've got this delusion, you forgot where you come from. But this state is not permanent. Even this God consciousness, the things beyond that. And even what's beyond that isn't permanent. You know, the jhana realms aren't permanent. But where the consciousness finishes and ends, the anidasana consciousness, where name and form, the objects of consciousness, totally cease without remainder, that there is no beyond, total cessation. And for God, at least he realized that Buddha has to be onto something because of the Buddha's greater psychic powers. But that second sutta, where that monk Kewada asked him, he said, look, I can understand such a place exists, but I don't know where it is. Go back and ask the Buddha. And even that sutta was showing that even the God understood the Buddha's greater wisdom. It's a rare religion which actually has a God and confutes God. But for those of you who are interested, I think it's in, I remember reading this, but I've lost the quote, in the Gnostic Gospels. This is an Anag Hammadi library. These were those Gospels, supposed to be sayings of Jesus Christ, which were discovered in ancient papyrus manuscript in the village of Nag Hammadi in Lower Egypt. Elaine Pagels was the person in charge of this, who translated most of it. These are supposed to be real sayings of Jesus. It was part of the Christianity which was suppressed by what is now the Catholic Church. However, these things kept on reappearing, the Gnostic Gospels they're called. And in the Gospel of Thomas the Contender, there I remember, I should have written down where it came from, the page number, there God is in his heaven, this is Jesus' Gospel, saying a story, God is in his heaven saying, I'm the great, I'm the most powerful, I am the first, the creator, the maker, the father. And then he hears a voice, no you're not, there are beings more above you, superior than you. And God replies, who said that? I don't know who said that. Why is they saying that? And that's in the Gnostic Gospels of early Christianity. So even in early Christianity, they had a very, very similar idea. That the Christian idea of a God is only a very high being, but beings even higher than that. And a God who is not permanent, who is not all-powerful. And that's in the Christian Gnostic Gospels. Interesting. You find that fascinating? Anyway, hopefully. Any comments or questions on this before I have to go to church? There's an interfaith Commonwealth Day service and then another discussion. Yes? Okay, yeah. This is, if you know your types of craving, there's three types of craving, the craving for sensual experience, the karma dhanha, the craving for being, bhava dhanha, and what the Buddha pointed out, the craving to annihilate yourself, to stop things. Now that's when a person understands that there's nothing really to be gained in sensory pleasures. It's just like one of the Buddha's great similes, all the sensory pleasures, they're like a dog, a hungry dog, finding a bone smeared with blood. It's got the taste of meat, but it never satisfies your hunger. That sensory pleasure right there, whether it's sex or movies or money or power, it's enjoyable, but it's not quite enough. You need something more. So all the sort of pleasures in the world are not satisfying, because you need something more afterwards. So it's just like a very tasty bone which doesn't fill you up. So that's the karma dhanha. Bhava dhanha is far deeper. This is the craving to exist, to be. It doesn't matter whether it's painful, whether it's pleasurable, but I want to exist. And the most refined of all was a person being that if you exist, you're always going to have this pleasure and pain, no matter where you go. You can't have just only pleasure, only happiness in any realm. It has to end because it's impermanent. And when it ends, no matter what pleasure, happiness, satisfaction you have, when it ends, that's suffering, that's a pain. That's why when people have a wonderful husband, when he passes away, that's, it really gets your heart, tears you apart. Because all that happiness is now gone. So the happier you are, the more painful it is when that happiness fades away. So that's why all being has that element of suffering in it. So a person who understands that, they want to get rid of being. But it's, I want to get rid of the being. And it's still, you're controlling things, you're trying to exterminate things. It's, again, it's the sense of I. And that's why it's to a being and me seeking to annihilate itself. You can't do that. It's exactly the same in meditation when you try to be peaceful. You just can't do that. You're trying to annihilate sort of your thinking, your restlessness, your sleepiness. We're trying to annihilate these things, and you find it never works. So instead of annihilating the objects, we're trying to stop the thing doing the annihilating. Stop the controller. And that's what the Buddha is doing. He's letting go of all of these things, not clinging to them. But if you try and annihilate existence, you just make more existence. You're trying to stop your thoughts, you make more thoughts. That's just an example. You just let go. Letting go means just stopping this controller. And then the thought ceases. And then the world ceases. And then you cease. That's one of the reasons why letting go is so difficult. In meditation, when you let go, what you're really letting go of is you. That's why it's such a tough thing to do. I'm asking you to vanish. You. And you can go so far vanishing, and after a time you go, no, I don't want to go any further. That's why people who go deep in meditation come across fear. Like everyone comes across, you go to a certain state, oh, I don't want to go any further. Why? Because you, as you know you, are disappearing. You're vanishing. And that's the most scary psychological barrier. Who you think you are. Anything about you, vanishing. So that's how it really works. But if you try and annihilate yourself, you just can never do it. The way the Buddha said, it's like a dog trying to chase its tail. You know, trying to eat its own. Or like my simile was from Oliver Twist. Like a man trying to eat his own head. Interesting to think, how can you eat your own head? So it just can't be done. Sounds like easy enough to annihilate yourself. But eating your own head is exactly the same thing. And that's more of a twist. Charles Dickens. Okay, does that answer your question? Oh, yeah, well, that doesn't really, sort of, but not quite, because it's actually people who know there's an afterlife, but they want to stop it. And it's just wanting to stop it, rather than stopping the wanting. Yes, Jacob. That's right. That's a good... Yeah, well, he does actually go away eventually. But remember, he's actually taken possession of someone. This is the big battle, because he knows that Buddha's going to get the top guys, his disciple. And so Mao's not going to sort of give up easy on this one, not on God. So he's trying everything in his power. And the last thing is, okay, you're enlightened. Shh, don't tell anyone. But this Mara, again, in the cosmology of Buddhism, this is the realm of power. And there's many different levels of happiness in this world, of joy. And this recognizes you've got the happiness of sensory pleasure. That's the lower heavenly realms. And above that, you've got the level of power. And anyone who has an understanding of pleasure know that sort of people in this world, they, you know, especially wealthy people, they've got all the sex, movies, food, they've got so much money. And what do wealthy people do next? They become politicians. Why? Because they want to exert power. Power is now sort of their joy. And so the joy, the pleasure, fulfillment of power is much more seductive and, if you like, higher than the pleasure of sensory enjoyment. And that's why that this being had so much good karma, got into that level of power. And as Lord Acton said, there's a very great insight, power corrupts. And great power corrupts greatly. So this Mara, a really good being, gets into this realm of power and gets totally corrupt. If you have power, you want power over everybody. When like a Buddha comes along and say, yeah, you're not under my power, I'm much more powerful than you, that really pisses off Mara to the max. And anyone becoming an arahat, fully free of this other beings, that really upsets Mara. That's why Mara does his best to try and stop beings becoming enlightened, because it gets them beyond his power. And that's just so much pain to someone like Amara. And that's why it always comes along. And all the, you don't need to, this is another important thing, you don't need to beat Mara, the Buddhist idea of a devil if you want, through force. It's not through willpower, but through wisdom power. I know you, Mara. Yeah, I know what you're up to. That's all you need to do. Wisdom is much more powerful than force. Especially willpower. So the Buddha doesn't need to go and have a punch-up with Mara, or just have a psychic battle, you know, throwing sort of psychic lasers at each other, like in some sci-fi movie. You need to know, I know you, Mara. And it's the knowledge of the limits of power. The knowledge of what control actually is, and what's beyond control. That's all that's necessary to defeat Mara. Just, I know you. The great power of wisdom. And you can see how it works here. Buddha saying, well, you know that you're going to go to heaven, you're going to go to, if you do what I say, if you don't do what you say, and carry on like this, Buddha, you go to hell, because I've been there, I know this. He said, look, I know much more than you, Buddha. I know who you are, what you're up to. And it's the wisdom that gives you the power. That's a wonderful thing. It's not force, it's wisdom power. And any time in your meditation, if you ever get stuck anywhere in your meditation, please, please, please don't use willpower. Because I'm going to push through my sleepiness. I'm going to crush my restless mind. I'm going to watch my breath. I'm going to sit here for 3 hours, 4 hours, 5 hours. Then you're completely under the power of Mara. All you need to do is just say, I know you, Mara. In other words, just be still. And when you know what the problem is, it's always you trying to control things or controlling. It's the Mara inside of you which wants to control and make yourself peaceful. The controller which wants to destroy your restlessness. So I know you, controller. So then the controller slinks away. And when the controller slinks away, there's nothing which is agitating your mind. The cause of restlessness, the cause of sleepiness, is undermined, then restlessness disappears. And every other barrier to deep meditation disappears. So if there's any barrier in your meditation, that's like a controller, like a Mara inside of you. All you need to do is see that, I know you, Mara. And then the problem vanishes. It slinks away. It's a great metaphor, but it's also a real thing as well. Controlling and letting go of control. But again, why do you control? Because that's what a self does. It's like the dogs next door, they bark. That's what dogs do. A self, a me, a soul, an I, that's what it does, it controls. So the only way to let go of controlling is you have to vanish and disappear.
It's hard to vanish totally, but at least in meditation you can vanish for half an hour or an hour. A temporary vanishing first of all, and then see what it's like. Okay, any other questions? Okay, the Brahma is more powerful, but it doesn't exert the power so much. Remember that the Mara took control over somebody in Brahma's assembly, but not over Brahma himself. Brahma is more powerful, but Mara is more sneaky. It's more sort of devious. Because Brahma is as a very beautiful being, it gets jhanas, very pure mind. So, it's got no sensory desire, no ill will. But certainly it's got a lot of delusion. Yeah, but it's just, you know, maybe out of a bit of compassion and kindness, not out of really your will. He really wants to help the Buddha. Say, come on, no, out of compassion, believe in me. How you can't do anything in jhana realm, but before he disappeared, he could probably just make that resolution. So you're in incredibly refined places in these very, very upachara realms, just before jhanas and going into a second jhana. That's actually my explanation of how the Buddha disappeared from Brahma. The only place where Brahma can't see, can't sort of have any knowledge of, is in the second, third, fourth jhana realms. So that would be the place where the Buddha went to. And left the stanza there for him. Physical body completely disappears. These you don't see Brahmas with a physical eye. This is all just the mental images. They say very clearly that even the devas are manomayakaya, mind made bodies. Only in the sense of manomaya rupa. So this is mind made. Refined, not same as physical bodies. Not really, no. So in other words, if any of you do ever see a deva, you're seeing it mind to mind, and you create the image of what you expect a deva to be. So Thai monks, because they've been conditioned to see these devas with these big pointy helmets, just like in their movies, that's what they see them as. If you've been born in a Christian country and see a deva, you see them with wings on their back. Because that's how we've been conditioned. If you expect them to have like radiant white clothes, that's how you'll see them. Because these things are real, but it's our perception adds on these details. So manomayakaya, mind-made bodies are like that. Because they're mind-made. There's an essence there of mind, but you add on these details, and that is the rupa which you see them as. Not out of the four elements, no. The four elements are just part of the coarser world. They call it, what is it called, the refined material? Refined material bodies, manomayakaya. It's the same material if ever you see a ghost, which is why ghosts, they can pass through walls. They're not passing through walls. It's just, you know, it's a mind-made thing, and so physical rupa has got no interaction with mind-made stuff. If you ever seen a ghost pass through a wall, it's obvious how they can do that, don't be surprised. You try it though, because you've got a course form and you'll never be able to do it. Okay, some high, interesting Dhamma today. And it's a very deep one, just a fascinating one about how Brahma is, and gods, and Maras, and how Buddhism has an idea of Brahma, and Mara, and all this other stuff. Fascinating, but I also wanted to point out the bit about the bhikkhunis. It was an original idea of the Buddha 8 days after his enlightenment, not something he was persuaded to do by Ananda. And the Buddha said he will not pass away until he's established those things. That's how important it was to Buddhism. Okay, so we'll now pay respects to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, the Arahant Sammasambuddha. We can go off to have a cup of tea, or myself go off to my next meeting.
Arahant Sammasambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namami.